Good evening and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art and tonight's program. I'm Laura Hauptmann, a curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and I am the moderator for tonight's discussion. Barnett Newman once commented that only a society entirely composed of artists would be really worth living in. Had Newman lived longer, he could have moved to Williamsburg, where his premise may or may not have been sorely tested. But the empirical evidence of Bedford Avenue with its organic coffee bars and whatnot does not detract from the fact that Newman, along with a number of his fellow artists, painted as if their lives depended upon it and believed that the making of art was a spiritually significant, even ethical act to be undertaken with dignity and high sense of purpose. This discussion has been convened not to question the validity of Newman or other abstract expressionist beliefs, but to inquire as to whether in our time of sometimes vicious debate between science, faith, reason, and culture, it is possible to see contemporary art as a vehicle for spiritual power, for human transformation, or for metaphysical investigation, and if so, how. These ideas, however ancient, however difficult, and however difficult to articulate, and I wanted to tell the panel that mime will be allowed during this discussion, these ideas have always been around, but they're particularly trenchant in our fin de siècle moment, when, to paraphrase Terry Eagleton, history continues to act big, and culture continues, in many cases, to think small. The philosopher and novelist Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein describes our time and our intellectual struggle succinctly, I think, with the opening paragraph of her new novel, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God. She writes, "Something shifted, something so immense you could call it the world. Call it the world. The world shifted, catching lots of smart people off guard, churning up issues you had thought you had settled forever beneath the earth's crust. The more sophisticated you are, the more annotated your mental life, the more taken aback you're likely to feel, seeing what the world's lurch has brought to light, thrusting up beliefs and desires you had assumed belonged to an earlier stage of human development. What is this stuff, you ask one another, and how can it still be kicking around, given how much we already know? It looks like the kind of relics that archaeologists dig up and dust off, speculating about the beliefs that once had animated them to the best they can be reconstructed. Gone as they are now, those thrashings of proto-rationality and mythico-magical hypothesizing, and they should be nearly forgotten. Now it's all gone unforgotten. We plan to cast our net wide tonight, but our focus will be on art, its making, and what it does and can do in the world. We have a particularly able panel to address some of these issues, two artists and a scholar, each of whom has a unique take on the subject or subjects at hand today. The format of the discussion, which we hope will be a quasi-informal and open-ended one, will be that our troika will discuss whatever issues they want that fall under our very broad rubric of the uses of contemporary art, metaphysical and not, with no prohibitions against fuzzy thinking, sticky language, stops, stutters, or invocations. The ideas we want to examine are not at all easy to talk about, so for my part, anything goes. After this time of questions and talk, I'd like to open the floor to the audience. You don't have to formulate your comments as a question, but I do ask that you participate in the discussion rather than use the time as a platform for your own metaphysical speculations, psychic time travel, etc. Now it's my pleasure to introduce the members of the panel this evening. Tauba Auerbach was born in San Francisco, and she studied at Stanford. She started exhibiting her work less than a decade ago, but since then, her optically challenging, graphically intricate, and logically probing paintings, drawings, prints, and installations use abstract forms, symbols, and lettering, both to lay out hypotheses on information systems, test them, and create new ones, with the aim of discovery. Her work has been seen at the Whitney Museum of American Art, SF MoMA, the Wattis in San Francisco, the Castello di Rivoli in Torino, the New Museum, MoMA PS1, and the Macro Museum in Rome, among many, many other museums and galleries. Upcoming are exhibitions at the Bergen Kunsthalle and Paul Cooper. Although Tauba's work can most often be seen in an art museum or a gallery setting, her interests have long overlapped with those of science. Her work, all of which is experimental and exploratory in nature, often probes the territory of the science of perception and multidimensionality, physics, and theories of the multiverse. And it's through the set of parameters that science poses that she finds her way to the more metaphysical issues we hope to discuss tonight. She's exhibited her work at the Science Museum of Minnesota, has been a guest researcher at the Microsoft Labs in Cambridge. Where working with the logician Byron Cook, she created a new math symbol. Recently, she completed a residency at the San Francisco Exploratorium, a very famous institution, experimental science museum, which for years had collaborated with artists. In 2009, Taubert collaborated with the musician Cameron Mesereau and invented the hourglass, a two-person pump organ, which sports two keyboards, each with alternating notes of four octave scales, to make the instrument impossible to play alone. Bryce Marden is one of America's best-known living painters, and I have to pinch myself that he's sitting right there in front of me. After receiving his MFA from Yale in 1963, alongside classmates Richard Serra and Chuck Close, Bryce Marden set up a studio in downtown Manhattan and began to create a series of quiet, nuanced, monochromatic paintings in subtly different shades of gray that would become the signature works of his early period. These works both looked back to the inchoate but content-full paintings of first-generation abstract expressionists, and looked around and forward to the self-contained, self-reflexive objecthood of minimal painters like Frank Stella, Robert Ryman, Agnes Martin, and others. They were, however, a singular achievement in American post-war painting that still have resonance today for those artists who wrestle with the stripped-down toolbox of form and color to communicate deeply but wordlessly. Since the 60s, Bryce Marden has created bodies of abstract painting that exhibit a mastery of color, sometimes intense like the sun, sometimes subtle and cold like the trees in winter, second to none. Incorporating calligraphic gestures since the 1980s, Bryce Marden's work has always retained the quiet, meditative soulfulness of the first monochromes, a kind of human abstraction closely tied to meaning or the search for it. Bryce Marden's work has been the subject of one-person exhibitions at the Guggenheim Museum, the Stedelijk, the Tate Gallery in London, as well as the Serpentine. In 2006, the Museum of Modern Art presented a retrospective exhibition, which traveled to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and the Berlin Nationalgalerie. Bryce Marden lives in New York. Last but not least, Dr. Michael Taussig, sitting on the floor here, is a professor of anthropology at Columbia University. He studied medicine at the University of Sydney and earned a PhD in anthropology at the London School of Economics. He began fieldwork in South America in 1969 and has returned to that part of the world for the past 40 years, producing brilliant, original, and multidisciplinary works of scholarship on peasant agriculture, slavery, hunger, commodities fetishism, the impact of colonialism, shamanism, and folk healing, the relevance of modernism and postmodernist aesthetics for the understanding of ritual, the making, talking, and writing of terror, mimesis in relation to sympathetic magic, state fetishism and secrecy, defacement, meaning iconoclasm, paramilitary violence from firsthand experience, exciting substances like gold and cocaine, and recently, unforgettably, color. Mick has written countless articles and 10 major books, the best known being the 1980 The Devil and Commodity Fetishism in South America, the 1987 Shamanism, Colonialism, and the Wild Man, A Study in Terror and Healing, the 1997 Magic of the State, in 2006, Walter Benjamin's Grave, and in 2009, What Color is the Sacred, which all of you should run out and buy immediately after the program because it is available in paperback. His forthcoming book on drawing and notebooks is coming out in the summer. He is also an advisor to Documenta. His interests range widely, as I have read, and they often touch on modern and contemporary art and aesthetics. He has written on drawing, on surrealism, on William Burroughs, and most famously on color in the What Color is the Sacred book, available in paperback. Magic, who creates it and who gets to use it, is a leitmotif in his oeuvre. Because of this, and for many other reasons, I believe I would like to start this discussion with you, Mick, and I'd like to invite the panel to empanel themselves.
Thank you, Laura. It's just agony to hear yourself described, and it's so wonderful to hear what terrific people are sitting in front of you. That was a great introduction. I'm going to read a little bit for 10-15 minutes, and I wanted to begin with Laura's question is that she emailed to the panel about 2 weeks ago. What is the I've called "What is the Sacred?" And then a week later, after she'd got some feedback, she came out with a completely different list, and I was sort of amazed at the sort of black and white nature, the contrast between these two sets of questions. For example, the first lot she had divided into three, on defining, on making, on experiencing, and in the section called on defining, she says, "In your opinion, what is sacred?" Okay, Laura, what does the, these are great questions.
This is going to be easy, Mick.
What does the sacred do? Who decides what is sacred and what is not? Is there such a thing as a sacred object, or is it only a relative thing? Is there a difference between the notion of the sacred and the notion of the spiritual? Dictionary definitions mean this, mean that. What does spiritual mean? So there's this like waterfall of questions directed at the heartland, you might say, of the something we might call the sacred. If you take away the image and take away the word, can you still make a sacred object? Does abstraction suit the sacred in art, and somehow better in these times, our times? And then a week later, I get these questions after further meditation on the author's part. Can art be a kind of tool to access areas beyond knowledge or beyond language? Can communication be inchoate? Do you see art as a way to communicate the inchoate? So I was thrown by the contrast between these two, what seemed to me to be two very different sort of frameworks or approaches to spirituality or spiritual life. One was very sort of spiritual and religious-like, and one was much more psychological and cognitive and so forth. And this seemed to me to be a sort of a replay of enlightenment, that I got the pre-enlightenment sort of burst on religion and things spiritual in the first set of questions, which is so like dramatic. And the second set of questions were a sort of a disenchantment, reflected a sort of disenchantment of the world and a search for a completely different, more sort of modern psychological vocabulary. And people often have described famously the disenchantment of the world. The German philosopher, poet Schiller, his phrase "disenchantment of the world" as the product or the motivating force of what we call enlightenment in the West. Latterly, we seem to be hearing a lot about re-enchantment. So this parallel that we find in Laura's two sets of emails questions seems to me parallel this issue of disenchantment and re-enchantment. And one of the things I was thinking about a lot without making much progress in my book on color, does re-enchantment take us back to enchantment, or is re-enchantment after disenchantment a completely different kettle of fish? Can you go back? If you re-enchant after disenchantment, if you agree with the disenchantment idea, and lots of people do, are you doing a sort of Hegelian Aufhebung thing? That is to say, you have to bear the ghost, the shadow of the previous enchantment. Is there something artificial about re-enchanting, you might say? When you read some of the statements by the famous abstract expressionist paintings, whose paintings are upstairs, like Newman, for instance, he talks about the spiritual as very emotional. He talks about we build cathedrals not out of Christ, but out of our own selves in these paintings and so on. There's a sort of reaching back and then an annihilation of that reaching back with a much more modern sort of emphasis on the spiritual in the face, perhaps, of hostility towards it. I was also thinking of this parallel with the famous phrase, the death of God, Nietzsche's death of God, where the madman comes into the marketplace and is ranting and raving in the gay book, The Gay Science, and says stuff like, you've killed him, you've done away with him, where are we now? The world is going sideways, upside down, there's no more orientation. That is exemplary, I think, of what we meant by, or could mean by, modernism. And at the same time, the madman says, you know, you haven't really killed him. And that's Nietzsche's whole point, that the death of God was just another phase in the sustenance and maintenance of a godlike principle for philosophers, with which he disagreed. Now, I wanted to sort of try and make some headway in this, thinking about the difference between what I call a heavy sacred and a light sacred. And when I read an article or approach by someone, an art historian like Robert Rosenblum, who talks about the abstract expressionist paintings you'll see in this exhibit here, as the return of the sublime or a modern sublime, I call that heavy, heavy sacred. There's something, it's hard to talk about. You're in the world of the ineffable. It's very complicated and mystical and, it seems to be beyond words. But as the light sacred I wanted to spend more time on is a notion of things sacred which stresses the sacred in everyday life. What the surrealists call the marvelous, things which have somehow got passed by most people, but if you stop and think about it, seem to be aspects of something quasi-miraculous, and that seems to me to have what motivated so much of surrealist writing and poetry and painting. In my world, the anthropological world, that was figured by the works of a guy called Durkheim, Emile Durkheim, who was the esteemed professor of sociology in Paris in the late 19th century and early 20th century, spawned a hugely powerful school and invented, so to speak, sociology. And Durkheim was reading Australian ethnography, 1899, Spencer and Gillen, the Central Tribes of Australia, and together with works on Native Americans, but principally it was the Australian, Indigenous Australian ethnography. Freud read this too, was super impressed, hence his book Totem and Taboo in 1914. And Durkheim came up with a notion of the sacred as a force outside, without requiring a god or monotheism, which people felt was diffuse throughout the universe, and most importantly had a sort of a positive and a negative pole. So that it was a dangerous force. It both attracted a person and repelled them at the same time because it was so. It was like that's its leading characteristic. So this attraction and repulsion, too dangerous to get close to, requires ritual, requires priests or priestly-like people to mediate between ordinary people and the objects or ceremonies of the sacred. And this was something that I wanted to think about in relationship to the work of the sacred that's very sensitive to the way in which the dead and the way in which the corpse, through the work of, say, someone like Bataille, can be seen as exuding a strongly negative sacred force. Now, if you think of the idea of the devil and God, I think you get straight away you understand what's going on here, albeit in a simplified sort of form, that the sacred is not only a force for good, it's also a force for evil. But I think for people who have grown up in my lifetime in the Western world, this is, I don't know, it doesn't come easy. The devil is a sort of a joke, you know. It's a sort of cartoon figure, but for the people who were coming out of surrealism in Paris in the 30s, this contrast between the way in which the corpse can produce a negative energy, which enables the church to sort of swell with positive sacred, was a very crucial paradigm for thinking about things sacred. And again, it reposes on this attraction and repulsion that's defining the sacred. Now, I've got to say, A lot of social scientists and anthropologists would get choleric, you know, if they heard the term "the sacred." It never sat well with American academia, nor with British. This is a particularly, you know, French phenomenon, the sacred. But it has it has a very prestigious genealogy, as I've just tried to give you a few pinpoints through Durkheim and Bataille, Michel Larisse with his absolutely exquisite essay, "The Sacred in Everyday Life," where he thinks back to when he was a kid, the advertising label on the chocolate can, the radieuse, which was the fireplace in the kitchen with this strange glow, his father's Smith & Wesson silver-plated revolver, the silk shirts on the jockeys in nearby, the strange antics he would get up to with his brother in the bathroom, the parents' room, bedroom. All these were like sacred objects or sacred places or sacred times, including the games kids play with language, mishearing adults, making up names, and so forth. This is to give you a sense, what I call light sacred, everyday things which have maybe a sense of the marvelous or the mysterious, completely outside institutionalized religion. When Bataille talks about the cave paintings in Lascaux, he talks about magical theories that people paint these bison and birds and so forth in order to kill them, that it's a magical act, sympathetic magic. If I paint it, that's going to help me get loot, you know. And Bataille, just to give you another example of how to come through this negative-positive thing, said the painting comes after the killing. The painting is to do with an expression of breaking the taboo through the killing and a sense of the sense of the marvelous. It's a very different sort of take, and it always revolves through things that are very difficult to understand, such as death and sex and so forth. Now, I wanted to tell you a little story, if I can get the image up. Yeah. The story I want to tell you when I first came to this city and I was writing a book on shamanism, in 1984 or 5 I was writing this, and I wrote everything in the book except the chapters on the actual rituals. And this is in the southwest of Colombia in a lowland jungle area called the Putumayo River drainage area. And I knew it was going to be hard. I played the tapes with the music. I had strong images in my mind of the years I'd spent since 1972, going back every year, and this was 1984, thinking how on earth was I going to write about these very tempestuous evenings when people took hallucinogenic drugs and the shaman would sing, and it could go on two or three nights, generally one night, four or five people, maybe 12 people, some there for sorcery, some there for just to feel the power of the experience, right? And I stumbled across this postcard, probably at the Guggenheim. And I sat it on my typewriter, electric IBM, which was covered with sort of, you know, birds droppings from all the, what did you call that stuff? White stuff that you used to put over the paper to cover over mistakes. And it became like a talisman. And I was thinking, what was it about this, you know, father of spirituality and modern art, et cetera, what was it really doing to me? And first of all, it quickly became like a magical object. You know, whatever we might want to say about the painting, its history and so forth, it just the fact is, after a few weeks, it just had to be there till I finished that very, for me, very difficult piece of writing. Second, I hope I'm not talking in riddles here, but to me, this was an exquisite image of the clash that was going on in my mind between what's called, we called structuralism and post-structuralism. All my friends were very heavy and very very clever at working with Levi-Strauss and structuralism, Victor Turner, a sort of British structuralist. But us young people and the nature of my experience, what I thought was going on, that none of that would cut it. We wanted to deal more with emotion. We wanted to deal more with the confusion. We wanted to deal with the fact that you don't impose order at all with these rituals. You just lurch from chaos one to chaos two. At the same time, there's a sort of thread connecting it all. And I offered that as a interesting sort of example. The rituals are very body-oriented. They're very visual at the same time because of the hallucinogens, but the whole body becomes a vibrating, lurching between wonder and pain. A lot of vomiting, a lot of shitting. The music is all abstract, no words. This gentle humming, which speeds up and slows down. So immediately you've got work of art, if you like, which is multidimensional, you know, music, body, and visual at the same time, larded with, for hours and hours and hours and hours, of emotional roller coaster, of paranoia and joy, of tears and laughter, and lots of storytelling. Now this seems to, and lots of humor, combined with, at times, intense paranoia because of the sorcerers and the spirits. So I wanted to bring this up because I want to give you a sense of the sacred, which has nothing to do with going to one of these big churches anywhere in this city or in this country or in the West. And it seemed to me most of the history of the world, and perhaps most of the world, in fact, this is what the sacred is about, what I've just described to you, that this sort of emphasis on a diffuse force, as Durkheim said, no God, the spirits, the sorcerer, the image of the sorcerer, and the singing and body manipulation to get one back into some sort of working shape. This brings me to contemporary art, which I wanted to show a couple of images of the work of Jimmy Durham, who's presenting himself here. I wanted to sort of move from the description I just gave you, a completely different sense of sacred, right, to a complicated, somewhat parallel sense of sacred, which uses humor, but now in an ironic sort of way. This is an art, I would say, on Jimmy's part, which is very, very suspicious of anything to do with spiritualism and mysticism and so forth. But because of the pain in it, that I see as the pain, and the mixture of the pain and the humor, there's a sort of piquant, mystical edge to it. And it's very hard to, for me to put this into words, but it's a, for me it's like a sense of the sacred combined out of humor and anti-anyway conventional mysticism. There's pain, there's loss, there's a great sense of hypocrisy, and at the same time there's a sort of frisson of humor and beauty around the edges. I thought I would move to one of his sculptors here and describe what he has to say about the turtle dance of the Cherokee. Moreover, he says in his book, A Certain Lack of Coherence, there are two important differences between our religion and Western religions. Firstly, ours is not an escapist religion. It is totally opposite to escapism in that it is in constant reference to the place, i.e. a specific piece of the earth where we live, the production of that place, and to our own political system formed therein. For example, the Cherokee turtle dance involves rattles made out of turtle shells. This is not because we don't have anything else with which to make rattles, but because turtle shells are a direct and literal link to the concepts conveyed by the dance. The dance itself is not a superstitious, is not superstitious. We are not asking a separate god or a spirit to make something happen. We are, by the whole of the dance, attempting, and this is the phrase I want to emphasize, to tune ourselves in, to tune ourselves in to certain ongoing processes in our environment, which we must know about in a critical and non-exploitative way if we are to maintain our lives in an acceptable fashion. We use the turtle, an animal of our land and as a direct symbol of certain concepts, because we see turtles every day doing things that are to us like those concepts. I wanted to show you this, another one of his sculptures, to try and convey or try and reinforce the sense of something that is sacred or quasi-sacred, is humorous and down to earth, and is keeping at arm's reach any of the Western monotheisms that we talked about in the, or I talked about. The he asks in one of his essays, to be an Indian writer, that's Native American, to be an Indian writer today means being on no path, contradicting yourself at every turn, so at least I want to face that condition and not act nice, pretending it isn't true. What am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to? Where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to do? Some folks say, why don't you go back home and live with your own people in those woods you claim to love so much? In the first place, those woods are destroyed. In the second place, I'm a human in the world in this century, just like you. It doesn't matter to me that there are contradictions, that they are irresolvable, because they are irresolvable. To be an Indian writer means being on no path, contradicting yourself at every turn. And I wanted to end with some of the poetry that, to me, helps build up this sense I have of this, what I call sacred light, L-I-T-E. It's a short poem. I'm calling it Object. It must have been an odd object to begin with. Now the ghosts of its uses whisper around my head, tickle the tips of my fingers. Weeds reclaim with quick silence the beams, pillars, doorways. Places change, and a small object stands defiant in its placelessness. Durable because it contains intensely meanings which it can no longer pour out. And pause here. Like a dead Comanche's pony, it bites the dust, its dry tongue dragging in the sand, and its eyes staring holes in the sky. The soul is torn, worn from miles of work. Who places these mateless, forlorn shoes in deserts? Who throws single shoes from windows of cars to deserted shoulders of highways? In honor of history and its marches, let us have a closet museum of dropped and discarded shoes. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Michael. Bryce. Hi. Thank you for the anecdote about the questions. And it's true, there were two separate sets of questions that were given to the panel. Absolutely right. I didn't see it as pre-Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment, but it certainly had to do with disassociating the notion of the sacred from the more conventional notions of the religious, I think.
I can just confess that I'm sort of conversation that Laura and I had is somewhat responsible for the second set of questions. And by no means is it evidence of is that second set of questions evidence of any kind of disenchantment. It's just enchantment through it through different means. And maybe more by way of reason than by way of belief in anything sacred, actually. So that's, we had a long conversation, and that's how we arrived at this the second group of talking points, I guess.
Can you elaborate on the convergence of logic and science and a discussion of spirituality and how one can reconcile those two in your mind?
I don't know if I can reconcile
or
them,
not.
But I feel like very quickly if you read about science, if you read about the universe, or try to even think about how everything began, you run up against some really big questions that overlap with the same inquiries that spiritual inquiries sort of encompass. And so for me, these aren't really like separate or warring outlooks necessarily, but I felt that I felt pretty strongly that I don't think anything is sacred, and that word alone was going to be limiting to me in the discussion, because I thought assigning value to any object or anything that goes beyond that actually would make it sacred, not just valuable to me or sacrosanct to me specifically. That calling something sacred implies some belief in an objective value system that you're connecting it with, and that's just not something that I see evidence for, and that I don't think I can necessarily get on board with that. So the word sacred was sort of a barrier to me in like getting further in this thinking as I was trying to organize my thoughts.
But tell me, you told me today also that you came round the more that you thought, and tell me more about how you came round to the reconciling the second set of questions that was more based on this, a notion of discovery and experimentation versus the first set of questions, which was really defining this whole notion in a more sort of conventionally metaphysical sense.
Yeah, I found myself sort of ping-ponging back and forth between the two emails that you sent. And I don't know if I necessarily made any progress with the notion of the sacred specifically, but I felt like the questions that it raised for me, especially connected to how people interact with art, were really relevant. And even just little things that I find myself doing that maybe I think are evidence of me maybe like buying into some fraction of that idea, like feeling that but for example, I have a series of work that's just images composed out of dots, black dots on white backgrounds. And so many times people have asked me, why don't you just print this? It would be so much faster. But I print the outlines of every dot and then fill each one in by hand. And I don't think this necessarily has anything to do with the sacred, but it definitely has something to do with a belief that I have that I can't necessarily, lay out logically, but I truly feel that putting that human energy into that painting makes it different than if it had just come out of the printer. And so that's like a way that I can connect the idea of reverence for objects or human energy being kind of like transported or conveyed through objects. Maybe that's relevant for me in some small way.
And that echoes what you've said, Bryce, and also what you've been quoted as saying about the human element in the work that you do. and I wondered if you could comment on that. And also, you said that once that you painted not because you knew, but because you wanted to find out. And I was interested to know that whether you think that making art is a way to explore things that one doesn't know or things that might be unknowable, things that can't be visualized. So two parts, one, the human element in your work, and then the other things, the way that you can use that human element to explore.
Well, I just think that, you know, that the human is sort of an infinitely complex being. And every movement, and there's so many juxtapositions, and there are possibilities in combining these elements, which I try to explore in painting, in coming up with images.
And do you think that painting or art making is some sort of vehicle to address some of the issues that we're? I mean, I guess I hope you think so, or else we wouldn't be here. But but is this? How does art figure into this discussion? How can art be useful in this discussion? You don't know. Anybody else?
I'm thinking about that. Are we talking about art?
It's a good question.
And I try to make art, and it's I think there are vast possibilities for art. I think art, it's not just a matter of like making beautiful things. I think, I, for a while, was working with, you know, trying to combine elements that basically would just create some sort of totally fantastic experience when you saw these elements come together. I was working on a stained glass window project, and I thought if you could, you know, there's some point you can combine these elements. And when you talk about the sacred thing, I, you know, there's all these systems, sacred systems, or systems that are just set up by various religions. You know. So I based mine on numbers and the elements and stuff like that. And I thought if you could combine this with light and, you know, the light have the color work in just such a way, you know, it could be in a certain place and you could be in, put into some sort of transformed situation. You know, it never works. I mean, I haven't been able to make it work, you know, but it's like, you know, I don't know whether it's a cop-out or it's a... But then at a certain point, you know, like when you're looking at art, you can be transformed. And this is a magical moment. And it sort of goes beyond all you talk in Kohate. I mean, you don't explain it, and who cares? You've got it, you know, and it's a form of enlightenment.
Does that happen when you're making work, too? Is that a way of, can you transport yourself when you're making as well? I mean, there are two issues. One is the making of it, yeah. The doing of it, the creating, and then the other is the receiving of it, or the, you know. Because you did once say that the painters were necromancers, but you said you walked that back a little bit. That was an earlier
notion. So they were worker priests.
Yes, yeah. Priests as well.
I got jumped on a lot about that. But, you know, I mean, and there are people that, you know, devote their work to it. I mean, Boyce was very involved with it. And, there's shamanistic aspects. I believe in it. And then if somebody wants to come along and say, no, there's nothing there. I mean, we were talking earlier, and it was like Frank Stella had famously said, what you see is what you get. But now if you look at some of those black stripe paintings, they look like sacred objects. And but I guess that's cultural.
It might have been maybe absorbed.
I wanted to say that, to me, first off, what has to be meant by the sacred has to do with trauma and sacrifice and justice. It's not just something that floats through the air and is a beautiful sunset. That's how I read the history of religions, anyway. And so I would think that the aesthetic experience, consciously or unconsciously, is going to be a reflection of that.
I guess I don't know if I believe in justice is what I'm saying. So because that implies some absolute value system. So that's the part that I catch on.
You don't.
On a
you
human
don't believe
level.
In justice?
On a human level, but some absolute level, I'm not sure. The jury's out. Not to make a pun.
Well, I don't know, even if it's not absolute. Getting part of the way there is pretty good.
What I'm trying to do is say that it seems
to me that religion is not, religion and the sacred has always been based on a notion of life and death and injustice.
An ethical, a system of moral values or ethical values? Values to live by?
Sure.
And, you know, I always thought of the sacred, I mean, maybe because I looked it up, but sacred and spirituality, that whole notion was about trying to explain things that were unexplainable, trying to give words to things that were inchoate. So in a weird way, much more empirical, much more towards Taba's notions, if I can say that, than the other, without a value, a judgment on them.
No, I clearly have no value judgments. That's sort of my point. But I have, this is just like my natural way of thinking about these things, and I feel like I wonder and sort of marvel at the universe all the time by way of them. And I think too that even if you say you think it never works, this effort to transport yourself or someone by means of a painting or any object, I think that the effort is sort of the end in and of itself in a way. It's like the act of imagining that other space that you're trying to travel to. I think that's valuable.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm saying
I think that's one of the most important aspects about art.
No, I'm sorry. Is it important aspects about art for the artist, or is it an important aspect about viewer?
Art. Yeah. I mean, making it is one thing, and having it just be out there and have it convey a system of beliefs, I think it's very important.
I really am going to say it again. So you are makers of objects or of things, and we are viewers or consumers of objects or things. I would like to know whether, in your opinion, the art object can transcend its objecthood itself. I think that there's a quote by Betty Parsons about her abstract expressionist artists that their notion of art allowed them to move it beyond the notion of the commodity. They could rise above the commodity, and the art object for them, those artists in her gallery, became something different, which is really interesting coming from an art dealer, by the way. But I wondered about that. I mean, is this a way can art do something? Can it transcend itself, its objecthood, or is it still just a thing? And the other question I'm going to ask you is what the difference between feeling and sensation is, or whether you can put some sort of animation. Can you make an artwork animate, give it spirit?
Someone told me the story of Carlos Castaneda came to their house, and this guy was a dealer, Native American material. And he just went around and said, "This is working, this is not working." Yeah. And, I believe it.
Do you mean the attributes?
I collect scholars' rocks, and you have them there as a sort of this microcosm of the universe or of the earth, and there are these reminders, there, and you stroke them and you touch them and you try to understand how things move, and I know I was standing there, I've got this one sort of that's called like a bamboo rock. It's just and I'm just sort of stroking it, and you're thinking, like, these guys have been stroking this thing for centuries and thinking about these things. And you become sort of not one with them, but you're on the same venture. And so I guess that there's the sort of the communion of the makers. But I think the stuff's out there. And sometimes it's working and sometimes it isn't. Mm. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work.
You just sort of lean in and switch it on, maybe.
Well, no. I mean, lots of times it just doesn't work. It's just stuff.
What do you think, Tava?
I feel like I go through that it's working, it's not working process in my own studio all the time. And it's like, I probably discard, for the series of paintings I'm working on right now, 15 for every one that I end up choosing to kind of like make the cut. And I can't really say what I'm editing for, because I think it's like a constellation of so many different factors that I can't, I can't identify all of them. But I know it when I see it, and I know it when it's not there. And I think that's a bit on the same. I know what feels like a conduit to more than just itself, and what doesn't.
I had a question for you, Mick, that might relate to your using as an example first Kandinsky and then Jimmy Durham, which is entirely different two sides of the spectrum, but do you think that there's a relationship between an aesthetic, since we're the receivers and you're the makers, or, a relationship between an aesthetic response and a spiritual response to the, a work of art or a phenomenon or something like that? Is there any sort of relationship between that? I mean, these two kinds of responses?
My instinct tells me yes, but my mind tells me that there's a great deal of friction as well between the possible meanings or emotional meanings and the world, emotional meanings of work of art and the world that it's part of. And that's not what I would normally think of as aesthetic. However, I think that aesthetics is a very big part of religious ritual, especially sacrifice, from what I read. The beauty of the sacrifier, the beauty of the animal or person that is going to be sacrificed, and so forth. So I think religious ritual is tied in intensely with aesthetic response, and I think aesthetics in politics and aesthetics in even in economics is generally overlooked. Big is beautiful. It used to be small is beautiful, remember? Now we have, you know, five banks that run the world and so forth. I mean, is this bigness really helpful, or is it an aesthetic choice? That's
Do you think that this is for all of you, then, and this kind of leads to it, is there an ethical value in sensual experience, do you think? I mean, is there something ethical about communing with or contemplating a work of art, do you think? Is there some sort of connection? The abstract expressionists, or Newman, didn't have a problem using the term, ethics when he was talking about art making and also art appreciating. What do you think?
No. I just feel like in no position to be an arbiter of ethics. Mm-hmm. So, that seems like I would really have to be faking it to say yes.
So is your search or your, not the search is too romantic, but your trajectory, your experimentation, whatever you do in your studio, is that then a really empirical, very scientistic kind of thing? I mean, you're experimenting to discover not something, but just for the sake of the journey kind of thing?
Somewhat. I mean, I'd like to think it's a little broader than that, but generally just guided by curiosity and curiosity kind of being the sometimes the end in itself, because it's not so much that I'm like, I have this thirst for information, I have like a thirst for the quest for information. So I'm not more satisfied by possessing it than going after it. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the spirit of, if one's spirit or the spirit behind something is its like animating force or its group of motivations, I guess that would be mine. But it doesn't have an end point right now for me.
And Bryce, what about you? Because I know I'm using a lot of quotes because we had that wonderful monograph that was the MoMA put out, so I've got a lot of access to your quotes. You said, the rectangle, the plane, the picture, the structure is but a trampoline to bounce on spirituality. So that is another. Art is a kind of tool to access knowledge.
I always thought of it like a sounding board.
Sounding board.
Yeah. Instead of trampoline?
I like the
trampoline. Trampoline is like.
I like that.
I don't know. I used to work, work a painting towards each one had a real, like it was a kind of goal, and it was form. And I thought if you got everything right, you would have form, and if you had form, you would have this great experience. I don't think that way anymore. I don't know. I don't know. It's very interesting. Like these things like this panel, or, you know, I gave a talk on Rothko a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it's very interesting, you know, like you say, oh, this is, I used to think about that all the time, and I don't think about it anymore. Mm. Now it's like, now the form has become like the body of work. And, you know, the body of work being a humanistic reflection. And not so much about specific experiences. I'm not talking about it.
One more question about art, qua art, and then I have a question for you, Mick, about the times. I mean, why we're here. But my question to both of you is that I guess it's fair to say, in a general sense, that both of you paint abstractly. Do you think that there's any connection between abstract language and this kind of search or discovery, this is there an attachment to metaphysics in abstraction? Not necessarily in your work, but in your work as well. I mean, is it just a kismet that we decided on two abstract artists for this discussion or not?
For me, I've just found it more open-ended and more useful for that simple reason. Yeah, I think that I have kind of a simple answer to that.
I mean, I really, you know, I believe it's a much more open experience. You're not led by any kind of, you know, by specific images, and it's not literary. And so it leads, there's the possibility for more open experience.
So that, just again to quote Barnett Newman, who's seems to be the shaman in my ear right now, and that then it allows you to make something as opposed to represent something.
Yeah.
He had made that distinction between a picture, which can represent something, and a painting, which is something.
Well, that was one of the great things about the Abstract Expressionists. I mean, they stopped making pictures. You see that in the show. You go in, you see the Gorkys, they're pictures. They're European paintings, you know, and then you walk into the Newman Room where you see a still. It's a completely different experience, you know, and you imagine still standing, you know, out in this landscape he was brought up in. It's just total insane thing, and he comes out and he paints it. It's just incredible, and it's an experience. It's not a picture of an experience. It's an experience if you're seeing it.
Does any of this have any application to some of the more, anthropological notions that you were speaking of at the beginning? Then can you make
I wanted
parallel?
To I wanted to sort of point to a different angle of questions, and that is, what about the role of certain objects or pictures? Like I showed this little postcard I had of the Kandinsky. I mean, it couldn't have been anything, that's for sure. But once it got put in the groove, like, I need this in order to be able to write what to me was like started off being an impossible task. How am I going to convey this curing, this magic of curing, to a middle class, northern audience? And I was thinking probably all artists and writers have certain habits. They drink certain sorts of stuff. They have certain sorts of pencils. They look out the window at this, that, and the other. I mean, aren't these all these sorts of quote-unquote superstitions an absolutely invaluable part of what we do and how we do it? And that's I think that might be a bit easier to come at it that way rather than, you know, hitting the sacred foot head on. That was one thing. I also wanted to think about. Haven't we got another sense of sacred going on here, which is the way in which art has been made into us, and galleries and museums have been made into sacred objects? Yeah. And doesn't that sort of get in the way awfully of the objects themselves? It's like you can't, it's hard to see through the aura, it's hard to through see the hype, you might say, of the modern gallery. And I was thinking of this work by Dave Hammonds on the Upper East Side here in a mansion on just off the park, in which he's got a series, like six or seven huge paintings. But you can't see the paintings because they're covered with garbage bags except for a few square inches here and there. And, you know, it's like a throwaway gesture on his part, like he's giving this to the art world and to the gallery, and it's in this really expensive-looking place on the Upper East Side, and he's probably gets... people may pay a fortune for these anti-art works, you know. And he's pointing attention to this sacred quality that we've bestowed onto art, which Laura's asking about the art itself, and I'm talking about the modern art object. Another thing is the police being called into the Gargosian Gallery downtown in Chelsea about a month back, because here were these, if you want sacred paintings, you know, go and see Kiefer. You know, it's dripping with Nordic and some people would think, you know, proto-fascist.
That's about the sacred.
Yeah. Okay,
it's that's about... That's a picture. But anyway.
It's sacred. And some young people were in there with T-shirts about Palestine on, and the Gargosian people got very nervous, and they called the police, and the police manhandled a couple of old people, and they were let out in handcuffs. Terrible things happened, terrible things happened. But so the Gargosian has become, the art gallery space has become a very sacred space, you might say. So this is an important thing for us to be thinking about too. It's very hard to talk about the sacred quality of art in the last, I don't know, 50, 100 years, and increasingly so, it seems.
But there's also a real battle going on between artists and architects.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, Philip Johnson designed one of the most horrendous museums. You know, and here was this art lover. But, you know, you have to fight, you know, to survive
space.
in these things.
Yeah. Terrible
space.
Plus,
you know, the whole idea of a museum is like, you know, that's pretty, not so hot either.
Right.
So, the idea that you try to turn this into some sacred, place. You know, when you're just trying to see the art.
Gets in the way.
I have to say something about Gagosian versus a museum. Far be it from me. But it's just that...
I didn't say it was a museum.
No, I know, but a sacred space. I mean, is Bulgari a sacred space, the jewelry store? Because that... Is it? I don't know. I mean, it's a place that gives value to things, but not value. I mean, value with a capital V versus value with a small V, right? Mm. And didn't they hustle those folks out because they were worried they were going to hurt the paintings? Which cost a lot of money. I mean, the protesters. I mean, it was a different
I didn't. There was nothing in the news reports I saw to suggest the slightest hint of that. They were watching the art, and they had these, what some people felt were...
I know, but weren't they worried that the art would get harmed? That was why the cops came.
It was being harmed by the message on their packs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, true. So true. So true.
It happened at the Pace opening in Beijing.
What was that?
There was an argument in front of a painting, and the guard came and knocked the guy to the ground. With a huge, and they just immediately closed the whole place down.
What was the painting?
I don't know.
I wonder if it was an argument about the painting or not. I had this other... I don't know, this is sort of attendant on this, that in her monograph on Barnett Newman, Ann Temkin wrote that for Newman and others, that modernism, the notion of modernism, in a way replaced Newman's Judaism, or rather organized religion. It became the spiritual construct to believe in. She writes, modernism provided something to believe in the most profound way possible. Blew my mind. I mean, and I thought to myself, is it conceivable that there could be a spiritual construct within the contemporary discourse today that might take the place, that could be as powerful as that and become a spiritual construct in which to see the a work of art? I mean, or are we bereft, in fact, and I need to talk about value with the, you know, in terms of the economic value more than the kind of values that people were seeking after the Second War.
Don't you think the economic value of a Picasso or something gives it spiritual value?
This is a good question. What do you think?
Mm. It does for a lot of people.
That was the thing about the Hammond show.
Mm.
That he was like really, you know, going against that whole, the economic, and I mean, he does it all the time. You know, this is just
heard that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think you're, Taba, when you see your pictures in a museum versus in a gallery, because you've shown in both, do you think it changes the meaning of the works or private home?
I mean, I think context alters the way we see anything, so yes. But and I don't think that the aura that you're talking about always works against things. I think it sometimes it kind of tricks you. You see something in a particular context and you think I should value this, or I should esteem it or just give it some attention. And so is that problematic? Often, I guess. But I just think it can be, it doesn't necessarily have to be a barrier. It can work in the other direction also.
I think, excuse me.
No, please.
The best place to see a work of art is in the artist's studio when it's finished. Mm.
Cheers.
And when it leaves the studio, it's all downhill. I mean, no, it really is. I mean, Rothko said, you know, he hated the idea of the unfeeling looking, unfeeling eyes looking at his paintings. And that's usually when the thing is at its highest point. It's just been finished, it's there, and it's in this kind of situation, which it sort of creates the situation. As you make a piece, everything starts falling in place in the studio, right? I mean, just, and...
at its best.
Yeah.
But what about that beautiful Kandinsky that Mick was seeing in reproduction that he put on his Selectric typewriter? There was something that translated from the actual object, the painting, that some sort of magic, spirit, juju, whatever you want to say, that was in that object. And I don't know whether, I mean, it's a question. Was it in the composition? Is it in the colors? What is it? What is it that made it a talismanic object?
It's in you making it into that thing. Yeah. I mean, anything can become sacred. Just somebody has to say it's sacred.
That's what I think I'm saying, yeah. And also how highly contextualized and detailed it is. Like I talked about, and I said, I hope I'm not talking in riddles and structuralism, post-structuralism, all this stuff which is part of my, bread and butter, not necessarily anybody else's. So all that stuff is involved in that, right? It's a very tight cocoon that's being woven around the ultimate meaning of that, or stage one of the ultimate meaning.
Taba, well, you and I had a very interesting quasi-discussion. It was a short talk about how people looked at your pictures, and particularly the ones that were optical in nature. Do you want to... what we said was that some of the optical pictures that paintings that Taba has are often received or interpreted in a way that you don't agree with. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's hard to know. But yeah. As best as I can tell, sometimes, well, people are wary of tricks, which I appreciate. But I think that when a piece of work does something optically jarring, sometimes it's you can mistake that for a trick when it's really something. And because a trick kind of involves phoniness or a lie somewhere in there. And I'm not really, that's like in no way part of my process or agenda. So that's always, I don't know, something that I would maybe hope to, hope was not part of the way that those works were received. But I have a limited amount of control over other people's eyes, their unfeeling eyes, if you will. And I'm not sure that all the unfeeling eyes looking at those Rothkos changes the Rothkos, for example. So
it does.
You think it does?
Have you ever noticed how maybe every 5 years all the Rothkos start looking very dull?
Then they
start coming back,
That's why in really sophisticated art galleries and museums, you're not allowed to take photos. They can also damage the photo.
Do you think they're stealing the aura?
Spirit,
yeah, the spirit away. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's animate in there. But do you think that animation comes from the artist, or do you think it comes from all the unfeeling eyes and the, and I mean, we were saying both. We're also saying that the meaning of the picture or the artwork changes the way that people worship it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, you know, that happens too. You know? I mean, you talk about the economics. I mean, a lot of it, you know, you get a lot of this, oh, this is good because it's expensive, you know. Or they try to make it good by making it expensive or something like that. You know? It doesn't have anything to do with it. It has nothing to do with it, you know. Economic, you know, a work of art is a work of art. And that's it, you know. And all the, you know, the whole business thing is just, that's something else.
It's a different kind of power, I think, perhaps. My guess. Would you all agree that we could maybe do, would people in the audience like to ask questions and or comment on this rather
sure.
wide-ranging discussion? Or maybe, yeah, ask questions either of the panel or make a comment?
It seemed like some of what you're, I'm thinking of a Thomistic principle of beauty, the splendor of form, form being the idea. And it seems like you were touching on that. You know, you have an idea, and you start a process to put light, splendor into material statement. Thomistic principle. But that idea is very important. That starts you on that process.
You mean you're saying that the possibility of being able to do that is the key? The whole notion that you can do something when you start making an artwork.
The idea tells you you can do it. Why you have people who are painters who never studied painting.
Yeah, where does it come
the
from?
The LBI movement. But the question is just relating to what you were struggling to say. So when you say something is... nothing is sacred, it also tells me everything is sacred.
Yeah, don't those kind of...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go hand.
You don't want to...
I don't want to...
separate it. There's sacred things you do when you do art, and then you do secular things, like you eat and such.
I don't know if I do sacred things when I do art, but I think that what was just said a minute ago, that anything can become sacred if it becomes meaningful to one person in that way. To me, that all cancels out and makes nothing sacred in like a larger objective way. And I don't, there's no part of my personal art practice that's motivated by trying to get to something sacred, but there is, it's largely motivated by trying to sort of put outward pressure on what I perceive to be my existing limitations. And I guess that as an endeavor is like some effort to transcend something. And I think that relates at least obliquely.
I had a different idea. I don't think of this transcending of the self. I think when something feels it's engaged with the world right, at least for the moment, you know, I think that's, to me, a magic moment. But I don't go with that vocabulary of, you know, the self and transcending the self. It's a relationship between the work and what the work's about. In writing, I'm talking about writing and some drawing. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. When you create a work of art and you've decided that it works, isn't that your sacred? And to me, you talk about heavy sacred. Isn't heavy sacred, for me, fleeting?
Fleeting but heavy.
Yes. To me...
yeah, you know, I'm with you.
And life is beautiful tensions. And to me, the heavy sacred is the fleeting. It's fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree? Or?
Yeah, I would agree.
That's your sacred.
I can't tell if you're looking at me because the light's in my eyes.
I'm looking at you.
No.
Then what is that place? You know.
I don't. I'm afraid I don't have a great alternative word for it.
I'm naming it. Do you have a name for it?
It's a place.
It's a place. It's definitely a point that you've reached, mm-hmm. realizing it works. It works. The peace works.
For me, yes.
For you. It's fleeting. The heavy sacred to me is individual and fleeting for everyone. You don't name that place? It's a place.
I don't have a name for it.
Well, name it.
Why must I name it?
Because I call it the sacred.
That's fine with me, too.
Okay, but then it's semantic.
It's not my word for that.
I agree, yeah. But it's a lot, yeah, we'll get around to talking more about it. I want to ask you more.
Hi, I just have a question to the makers of art. I really got that you both said that the reason you loved expression painting is the openness and the possibility that presents to you. My question was, as you're painting, it seems to me it is complex. It's not a simple thing. But that you bring your personal history, your personal experience to it, and also it's contextual because of the times you live in or you lived. I mean, you can't divorce yourself from that. But are you aware of times when you go beyond that, when you lose yourself? I mean, you might have an idea for a painting. Are you aware of when you're in yourself and sometime when you just lose yourself and then you come back? Or is it just something that just happens?
I definitely lose hours, which I think is part of that. When time kind of stretches and contracts, I think that that's part of that phenomenon of, maybe that's a moment where you're extremely present in the here and now, or maybe it's a time when you're really divorced from it. I'm not sure. But it's because it's flexible, I think that happens. For me.
Yeah, I used to, there used to be this thing where you would try, you would be working and you would just lose track. You'd say, well, that's when you're really painting, you know. I find that happens less and less and less. And that's been, you know, but my painting has evolved, or the method has evolved, whereas everything is intuitive. So everything that sort of ends up there, there's no real, there's no thought out explanation. It's intuitive, but the intuition is becomes more and more honed, as you go on, and. So I don't have these moments where I think I'm just really painting.
Anymore or ever? You're saying it happens less?
Less. But, I think about it much more than I actually physically work on it. I mean, that's been the evolution. I used to physically work on it much more and think about it less, but I'm older now.
One open-ended question. I know that Buddhist thought played a role with certain artists during the abstract expressionist period, and I'm wondering if perhaps a Buddhist sort of approach to thinking about some of these issues would be helpful. I just would like all of you to comment on it, if you could. The idea of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness, in my understanding, being the totality of being and non-being prior to our concepts and judgments. Attachments of whatever sort. So would that be helpful in thinking about the sacred? And also the idea of museums and galleries as sacred places. It seems to me, and I do think of them actually as sacred places, I think in a good way, but it seems to me that most people see them basically as places to socialize and date. not to necessarily commune with art or the mind of the artist, the ideas of the artist. So could you also comment on that, please?
What about Buddhism? Buddhism and abstract expressionism? Anybody?
Buddhism in
general?
I never
thought it was a very strong... Yeah.
Well, for you...
Well, Zen thing.
Yeah. For you it is, yeah.
Well, I mean...
Work is always a balancing act and an adventure of form and content. So in that rather abstract way, I'd like to endorse what you're saying. I sound like a rabble-rouser, but I can't see living in those abstractions for too long. What sort of content is one talking about? And that's where it seems to me questions of justice and injustice and ugliness and danger and trauma just flood in. And I can't see how one could talk about art without, whether it's writing or painting on the wall or whether it's ritual, without these forces being invoked. So it seems to me there's a very strong and powerful and fascinating force within Buddhism called Tantric Buddhism, in which that is omnipresent. The meditation on the corpse as it decomposes, and endorsing of the negative sacred on different types of sexual practices, on different ways, regimes of the body, and so forth and so on. I mean, for heaven's sake, painting is not just things on the wall. I mean, painting in many places involves the ascetics of ritual in a full-blooded way, which involves families and communities and power. So, form and content, that's, you feel it working when you're working, right? But it's always got some substance in it, some materiality and some historical power, right? So if we're talking about form and content in that way, yes, but if we sort of elevate it up too quickly, to an abstract geometry, I lose sight of it. I think it's a false sacred then, a phony sacred.
I mean, you bring all your experience. When you're focusing on a work of art, the viewer is bringing all their experience to it. And you can summon up, vast quantities of experience, and it can be an incredible experience. I think artists are very aware of this, and they try to bring it up. There's all different ways of controlling it, but it's there. But as I said, the sounding board thing, it's not just our job, it's your job. You're going to get anything out of this art thing.
I was just curious, in really listening to all these great comments and your ruminations.
Closer in the mic.
Oh, sure. So, so much of the situation of abstract expressionism at the time, obviously, was this very tightly wound belief system. At least that's my perception of it, both also spun by the critics as well as by the artists themselves. And this desire to create something, which is a word no one's used this evening, which was this notion of the universal. And I was just very curious about, to me, I experience our current life as not a collapse of belief system, actually a multiplication of many belief systems, which makes it much more difficult to have the more singular readings to an extent that existed within that period of the 40s and 50s. Mm. And in a way, I thought each one of you actually reinforced at least my take, which is to bring highly personal, highly individual takes on whether it's the sacred, the making of art.
Yeah.
And, I don't feel we'll ever have what we had back then, or maybe they never had it then. I think it was an illusion then, although I must say I love all those illusions. I'm great fans of those works, and I can lose myself in them. But I was just curious how you feel about my read of it. That's my take.
That seems very fair to me.
When I was a kid in Australia, we saw pictures of some, I think a photo show here, The Family of Man. And that stressed the unity of mankind, and that's how we grew up. And when I entered anthropology in the U.S. in the 70s, that was the belief. And within about 10 years, all the textbooks and stuff had come out and completely the opposite, that celebrating diversity. That and presumably that means diversity of opinion and belief as well. And it has been a radical shift. But right now, it's not just, there's a sort of vitriol, and as they call it, you know, there's a sort of violence in the air, which is very disturbing. I don't know how uniform those abstract expressionist guys were, actually. I mean, you look at a lot of their statements, and boy, I think they speak beautifully, at least the stuff that I see in print. But they're not just micro differences. Or if they start off as micro or minor differences, they soon end up as pretty large differences. So, the unity and the uniformity, in some general sense, the family of man might be there, but they're all very individualistic, I thought.
It was also a historical moment. I mean, I don't think, they sort of had a historical job to do. They had to redefine it. And, you know, I mean, they didn't have to, but thank God they did, you know. And, there was this real break from Europe. And, you know, but it's also interesting when you go see the show, how different the show seems from when it was happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go in, you know, the way they have the Rothko's hung, you know, they have this, you know, like, boom, here's a Rothko. You would go to a Rothko show at the Sydney Giants Gallery, and these things were floor to ceiling, and you walked in, and they just killed you. You know, it was an amazing experience. And you go see those Klein shows, and they bounced you around the room. You know, now they have these things sort of like objects. You know, so I think, you know, and you know, these grander ideas that they talked about in those days. You know, I think. You know, they were really involved with it, and you know, and it's sort of been dissipated by this kind of representation. Yeah.
Back there, and then this gentleman here. First, this lady over there. This gentleman. Sorry.
Thanks for waiting. A question for Ms. Auerbach and Mr. Martin, if they're interested. I want to follow a line of inquiry that Michael Taussig began to develop, having to do with the potential of a ritual object to assist, to provoke the creative act. And I was curious if either of you can identify a series of repeated practices or a reliance on specific objects that you return to, or that you once returned to, that helped to, as you engaged in your creative work. In the way that Michael used the Kandinsky as a spur and as a talisman for his creative effort, can you identify either a ritual practice or ritual objects that you have relied upon?
You know, sometimes it's not wise to tell people what these things are, that you might rob them of their power. Please.
Well, I used to ask, you know, what's your ritual? You know, Rauschenberg always washed the dishes. He cleaned the place up before he went to work. You know, I always wear a hat when I paint. And I never have money in the room. But, you know, and that's, it's part of my ritual. You know, and it's a much more complicated, but I think a lot of painters have real rituals.
I don't have a ritual. I'm a really unroutine person in my day-to-day life, but I do, and I don't have anything that I consider talismanic, but I do have some objects in my studio that I like having around because I feel like they sort of they spur me, to use that word, your word, into the kind of headspace that I want to be in. I have some puzzles that I haven't been able to solve, for example. I have an upside down map. I have several Klein bottles, which are these glass vessels that basically have no inside and no outside. And I like having these things around, but I don't feel that I rely on them or that I would necessarily have like bad luck if they weren't present.
Sylvia Plath, I remember, used to play the I Ching with Ted Hughes, her husband, before sitting down to write a poem. It must be an incredible thing to sit down at a white piece of paper. It's all blank there.
Or a blank canvas.
Blank canvas.
Same thing. Sir? This gentleman here.
Is it possible to find a more neutral setting for the art? And if you said that somehow begins to lose its power once it leaves the artist's studio, and it seems to me it'd be rather infeasible to limit your audience, unless it's somebody came to mind was Ray Johnson, who kind of worked outside the gallery system and the museum system.
I don't know what could be neutral. I don't know if such a thing exists. I think museums and galleries are designed, some of them, with the idea of eliminating other elements that might interfere with your viewing practice. But I think we all see how that's just introducing other elements into your viewing experience. So I think we're all probably stumped on what would be neutral.
I think we have time for one more question.
I had. I like to think that I exhibit and other artists are exhibiting as part of an ongoing debate. And and so we have this, gallery system, museum system, and stuff like that, and it's not ideal, but at least the debate, you can take part in the debate, you can see the debate. And I always find it very exciting when you go to the galleries and you see that there's all these other people participating in the debate. I mean, just going out and seeing this stuff, it's very exciting. Makes this city very exciting because you go to other places, you just don't see it at all.
Maybe if you were able to make a really neutral physical space, I don't think we could, that we wouldn't have a neutral headspace because we have this ongoing debate and this dialogue and this things we've seen in the past and thought in the past, things we've changed our minds about. And I think neutrality seems impossible in that like internal way, not just the physical way.
One last question, ma'am, in the back. Sorry.
Hi. When I was a teenager, my parents took me to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I saw this Greek sculpture that I just had this experience where I was just completely transfixed and like just stopped, and like for 45 minutes, my parents like went off and they're like, okay, well, we'll come back and get you because you don't seem to be moving. And, and I think I've spent my whole adult life trying to figure out what that was. You know, what was that feeling? Like, I don't remember what I was thinking about or if I was thinking at all, but just somehow there was something happening there that felt very, very real. And, I guess I sort of assume that other people who, choose to spend their whole lives in and around art maybe feel that too. I mean, maybe you guys have felt that too, and have you been able to figure out what this is?
I certainly feel that too, but I have not been able to figure out what it is. And I think it would lose some of its perceived magic if we could.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, panel. It wasn't easy, and we deeply appreciate it.